foes, they're in business together. Daddy Bush knows the Carlyle Group, since years before, been raking in billions and itching for more.
It's blood for oil, we know there's a link.
They say code war,
we say code pink.
It's blood for oil, we know there's a link. They say code war,
we say code pink.
Code pink for freedom, code pink for peace. Was not Iraq, but Iran.
They feed you lies, don't want you to think.
They say code terror,
we say code pink.
They feed you lies, don't want you to think. They say code terror,
we say code pink.
Code pink for freedom, code pink for peace, code pink.
That was Emma's Revolution, and I'm Marcy Winograd. Welcome to Code Pink Radio, presented by WBAI 99.5 FM in New York City, WPFW 89.3 FM in Washington, D.C., KPFT 90.1 FM in Houston, KPFK 90.7 FM Los Angeles, and many other community radio stations such as KBOO in Portland, KCSB in Santa Barbara. You can also hear us on Spotify and Apple Podcasts. Do check out our website at codepink.org, where you'll find the latest on our campaigns and all of our radio episodes and podcasts. On this episode of Code Pink Radio, we bring you a conversation with Medea Benjamin, co-founder of Code Pink, and Ann Wright, former State Department official, on congressional demands for a ceasefire in Gaza and the status of President Biden's request for another $105 billion for more weapons to continue the U.S. proxy war in Ukraine, further arm Israeli genocide in Gaza, arm and train the Taiwan military for a war with China, and fund more border police and immigrant detention centers. During the second half of our radio podcast, we will speak with Bill Deer, the director of the Washington, D.C. office of UNRWA. That's the United Nations Relief and Works Agency for Palestine Refugees. First, we go to Medea and Ann. I'm Marcy Winograd for Code Pink Radio. It is my great pleasure to be with my Code Pink sisters, Medea Benjamin, co-founder of Code Pink, and Ann Wright, who was a diplomat for years, who resigned in protest over the U.S. invasion of Iraq. Good to be with you both.
Good to be with you, Marcy.
Yeah, Marcy, keep going.
Okay, and you too. Now, you both have been on Capitol Hill during these horrific times as we watch the bombs fall on Gaza. I mean, it's being televised, this genocide, right? And the resumption of the Israeli assault is devastating, as you know. So tell us what's happening on Capitol Hill. If you want to start with some good news, go right ahead.
Take it away.
Well, the good news is that there's now 48 members between the House and the Senate that have come out with some form of a call for a ceasefire. There's 19 of them that signed the Cori Bush resolution, and then others have done their individual statements. On the Senate side, where we have been focusing, it's only 4 senators so far. But even Bernie Sanders, who won't come out for a ceasefire, has at least talked about conditioning aid. And there are a number of senators who are talking with each other about this issue of conditioning aid. Now, for us, it's a non-starter because we don't want any money going to Israel, but it does show that there is light between what the administration wants and what's being discussed in the Congress. Now, this amendment about conditioning aid will be shot down. It might not even get a vote, but you know, Marcy, we are so far from where we want to be in Congress. We've have to take the little wins in that at least they're talking about it. At least we can go from office to office demanding it. And the other positive thing is that we have been in the offices every day now for this last month, and that you see a sea change. One, we're getting a lot more meetings than we got before. And when we get the meetings, we can tell from the way the staff members talk to us that they're really on our side and that they don't like the position that their boss is taking. They can't say it explicitly, but it's pretty clear from many of the discussions. And the other thing is the staff itself, you know, the people who are behind the desks when we walk in. We've even seen a young woman wearing a keffiyeh who we asked, what's it like to be wearing a keffiyeh in Congress? And she said, you know, it's fine. I only get positive feedback. She's never had any negative feedback. And we know that there are hundreds of staff members in Congress who have signed a letter anonymously because they don't want to lose their jobs, saying that they want a change in U.S. policy, just like there are so many people within the White House, USAID, over 1,000 staff members signing onto a letter. That's remarkable. And we know all the divisions within the White House itself.
And so, the State Department.
And the State Department. So we are inspired by that. And of course, it's not where we want to be, but at least we feel that the efforts of all the people who are calling the offices, who are doing sit-ins in offices in the local districts, who are joining us in the halls of Congress or going with other groups in the halls of Congress, because every day that we lobby, we find American Muslims for Palestine, Jewish Voice for Peace, other groups doing this as well. So that's the positive side. I'll leave the negative to Ann.
Oh, thanks a lot. Thanks a lot. Well, the negative is that still the administration and the the Congress still is not really pushing for a ceasefire. And as we saw today, the bombing resumed. There are over 100 people that have been killed in the bombing. So it's the negative part is terrible when we continue, you know, this is day, 52, 53 of the horrific genocide that really is going on by the Israelis in Gaza.
Yes. And, you know, I've lived a long time. We've all lived a long time, right? Decades. And I've never witnessed this sort of McCarthyism with a chokehold on speech and action in the United States, where people from the highest levels of government to just ordinary people afraid to say anything, right? They don't want to be labeled anti-Semitic. And my response is ad hominem attacks are the weakest form of argumentation. I'll attest to that as a retired English teacher. Before we talk more about Gaza, what's happening right now on the ground, let's talk about the good news out of D.C. vis-a-vis the United Auto Workers. Tell us about that.
We were at a rally today that was part of a five-day hunger strike that people were doing in front of the White House. And today was the day to show support from labor unions. And they had the electrical workers there. They had a number of locals who were there. In fact, right in front of me, I have a list of all of these unions, locals, just to give you a sense, AFSCME Local 88, Communication Workers of America, Local 7250, the Bronx Defenders Union, UAW, the
Starbucks
Workers United, the SEIU, many, many different locals of that. And what was really exciting is the United Auto Workers National, a huge union, very important, influential union in the umbrella of the AFL-CIO, has come out for a ceasefire. So that was something that was really applauded today. And it was exciting because now it's going to be easier to get other unions on board now that the UAW is on board. And we know that there have been the ILWU, the International Longshoremen Workers Union, has been active in several areas, including in the Bay Area, in the area around Tacoma and Seattle. And we are excited by that. So this union participation in the movement to call for a ceasefire is really bringing in a lot of grassroots support and a lot of influential people who have the ability to get the ear of members of Congress, So anyway, we're very excited about that.
Yeah. And let me just mention, you know, some of the other things that Medea didn't mention about unions, American Federation of Teachers, Wisconsin, American Federations of Teachers, Oregon, Massachusetts Teachers Association, Minneapolis Federation of Teachers. So we're encouraging the teachers union, you know, the teachers coming in for horrific negative comments from whenever they talk about the true history of what's going on in the Middle East. So for these teachers unions to stand up to say ceasefire now is really, really important.
Absolutely. I'd love to see my own union, United Teachers of Los Angeles, I'm a retired member, come out in support of a ceasefire. I think that what we need to do is post that list that you just shared on the Code Pink website, our Palestine page, and have it available for people who want to organize within their unions. And then my hope is that these endorsements will translate to action that will be crucial, action that totally disrupts that. I don't want to go on record here on Code Pink Radio, but I think you understand what I'm saying. You know, this is a time where we have to say, you know, basically what Mario Savio said up in Berkeley, throw your body against the wheels of the machine. Otherwise, things just grind on, right?
Absolutely. And while they're not throwing their bodies on the machine, we are excited that the Doctors Against Genocide, a new group has been created that has doctors from all over the country, and they're trying to work with health workers in general, with the National Nurses Group, and they will be in the halls of Congress and doing a press conference. We're trying to get them with members of Congress. You know, doctors are very influential, and we have seen as we've been going from office to office, when we put our doctors front and center and they get to talk about what's happening in the hospitals in Gaza, what's happening to patients, what's happening to the poor pregnant women, what's happening to the wounded who have no anesthesia when they're getting operations, the staff perk up and start to really understand the depth of the suffering that's going on. So that's another sector of our society, I think, that is important that it's speaking up. And we do have the California Nurses Association already on board.
Terrific. Now, let's get back to these senators. You mentioned four senators are supporting a ceasefire. And just so everybody understands, I believe that the Working Families Party has a ceasefire tracker that you can easily access if you just do a site search. The four senators that I have heard support a ceasefire, a cessation of hostilities, whatever you want to call it, include what? Murphy, Merkley, also Murphy
not,
of Connecticut.
Not Murphy. No?
Not Murphy yet. Okay. Merkley, Jeff Merkley of Oregon. Who else?
Peter Walsh of Vermont.
Oh, correct. Yeah.
Nick Durbin, Elizabeth Warren. Ohio, and Elizabeth Warren, Massachusetts.
Peter Welch of Vermont, Elizabeth Warren, she did, okay, of Massachusetts, Jeff Merkley of Oregon, and who was the other one?
Dick Durbin.
Oh, Dick Durbin. Okay. Now, missing from this list is Bernie Sanders, right? Much to the dismay, the shock, the disappointment, the outrage of his delegates. I was one of them. We sent a letter to Bernie, almost 400 delegates, saying we want you to support a ceasefire. Now, as a result, I think of a lot of pressure. We know people have been occupying their office, his office. He has said he wants to condition aid, the $14 billion in weapons that President Biden wants to send to Israel. He has set forth conditions. I don't have them right in front of me, but I when I read them, it was something like lift the siege on Gaza. And these are conditions that I would be shocked if they were met. So I guess that's his backdoor way of saying ceasefire. But I still don't understand why he can't come out and say it. It seems like something he just won't do.
Well, and as we talk with the offices of many senators who behind the scenes have been having meeting among themselves, they've been going to the White House, they said knock down, drag out conversations with the administration on the massacre that's going on, and demanding that the administration, the Biden administration, change its policies. And you can see that the verbiage has changed a little bit, you know, at least The Blinken and Biden are talking about, a more humane approach to the bombing and try not to hit the civilian population, which, of course, the Israelis are just throwing out the window. And in fact, starting the bombing of South Gaza while Tony Blinken was still in Israel, like flipping him the bird right there and bombing while he's still in Israel.
Marcy, one of the things that has been useful to take around is this ceasefire letter that was signed in 2021 when there was another, of course, much smaller Israeli incursion into Gaza. And 29 members of the Senate at that time called for a ceasefire. So we have gone to the offices of all 29 of those members, and now even more, to say, if you supported a ceasefire back then, why won't you support one now? And one of the responses that we're hearing is that Hamas is more of a threat than it was before. And they want to be able to support Israel in going after Hamas in a targeted way. So that's like Bernie Sanders and Chris Murphy. And what we have been saying to them is that every bomb that drops that kills more innocent people creates more desire for revenge, more people who are interested in joining an armed group, and that there is more sympathy for Hamas since October 8th than there was before, that this strategy is just not going to work. And when we talk to them about that, they kind of say, yeah, we know that, or yeah, that's a concern we have. But it doesn't mean that they're going to call for a ceasefire. So it's extremely frustrating to have these conversations. We've not only talked to members of the staff, we've talked to the senators directly. We've discovered that every week there is a briefing that is done in private in the intelligence committee. Sometimes it's about Gaza, sometimes it's about Ukraine, other issues, but it's a place where we can bird dog the senators as they're going into the meeting. So we've been able to run after them to ask them about a ceasefire. And sometimes we've had some interesting conversations, like Angus King, who went inside after trying to avoid us and came out and apologized and stayed with us for a conversation.
Yeah, well, he didn't try to avoid us. He just kind of looked back at us and said, what do you do? Love Hamas? Love Hamas? And we were going, no, we don't love Hamas. We just want to stop the killing. And then he just kind of gruffly went on into the meeting. And about 3 minutes later, here the door to the classified hearing room opened. And who was there but Senator King? And he said, I just want to apologize. I didn't mean to sound so terrible, but I still have my concerns, but I appreciate you all being here. And that's kind of a breakthrough. He didn't have to come back to apologize for calling us Hamas lovers, which actually Rubio did and never came back to apologize.
No, Rubio is just the opposite. Rubio even put out on his own Twitter feed a conversation that we had with him in which we asked him for a ceasefire. And he said, put this on camera. You're taping. I want you to know that I want Israel to be able to go after every single one of those Hamas horrible people that did horrible things, and no to a ceasefire, and post this. And so we wrote our own response and went to his office where we taped his response, our response, and it has gone viral, that people were very concerned to see what Rubio said. And then, yes, we went and posted messages all around his plaque outside his door. Today, we did that in the office of Chuck Schumer, where we put bloody hands on a paper and then had messages all around there as well. And so we have really been trying our best to talk directly to these senators, to stake them out, to get them on camera, and to let their constituents see what they're all about. Because, Marcy, as you know, the majority of the American people, 66%, and the vast majority of Democrats, 80%, want a ceasefire. So we're asking them, who the heck are you representing? It's not your constituents. It's not the U.S. public in general. it must be the lobby groups. And of course, when you look in what Open Secrets, the organization that posts the money that is given to members of Congress, you can see the huge amounts of money that these senators and representatives have taken from lobby groups like AIPAC.
Yeah, I say we bar Raytheon, Lockheed Martin, Northrop Grumman, Boeing, that makes the JDAMs, those 2,000-pound bombs they've been dropping on Gaza, bar them from the Capitol. I have to say that Angus King was nicer to you, Anne, than he was to me. I saw him a few months ago when we occupied Bernie Sanders' office demanding he support a ceasefire in Ukraine rather than expansion of NATO. And I saw Angus King of Maine in the lobby and I said, who are you? You look really familiar. And actually, I knew who he was, but I couldn't remember his name. And he said, I'm a senator from Maine. I am the senator, one of the senator, whatever. And then when I said, well, we're here to push for a ceasefire and not continue the war in Ukraine, he said, what are you, a Putin lover? So I guess he's got that line down. Whatever,
the Hamas supporter. He's probably got the Chinese Communist Party one to throw out as well.
Right.
He was nice.
I'm glad you brought up the data, the polling, Medea, on a ceasefire, because we see this tremendous disconnect between Congress and the U.S. public, at least the public that is being surveyed. Congress, I have to wonder if a lot of them are just fearful of being targeted in a primary. We know that AIPAC has pledged to spend $100 million to defeat some of the advocates like Rashida Tlaib for Palestinian rights. And they want to stay out of that line of fire, shall we say. But
well, that's right. And AIPAC has already shown itself to be able to do that. It took out Donna Edwards. It took out Nina Turner. It took out Jessica Cisneros and others just kind of scraped by to be able to win despite all the money that AIPAC put in the races. And yes, they've said now that they're going to raise $100 million to go after members of the squad, as well as Jamal Bowman. So it is extremely upsetting to see the power, as you said, of both the weapons companies and the pro-Israel lobby groups that are not just Jewish groups. They also include Christian evangelicals, groups like the Kufi Christians United for Israel. They are very powerful in our government. And now we're starting to see that we are able to counter them in terms of people power. Every time we ask the staff people behind the desks that are taking the incoming calls, what are the calls like? They tell us that they're overwhelmingly in favor of a ceasefire. And they're, they have online a place where you write a letter to the congressperson. One of the offices, they said that the overwhelming majority were coming from the point of view of the ceasefire. So they're hearing more from us than they are hearing from the pro-Israel side. But the pro-Israel side does have those very powerful PACs and has a lot of money that they throw around, not just at election time, but I think also it's happening right now.
And they also have the Speaker of the House, right? Mike Johnson from Louisiana, who's the new Speaker, the Republican. He is a Christian fundamentalist who believes in the rapture. What's the rapture? That's the belief that evangelicals hold that Christ will come back sometime in the future. This will be the second coming. And anyone who does not convert in Israel to Christianity will go to, I'm not allowed to say it on Pacific Radio, but will go down under, right? So we see this marriage between Zionist Jews and Christian evangelicals, and part of this whole rapture belief is that the Jews will not survive as Jews during the rapture. So I don't usually use the term anti-Semitism because it's become, as I mentioned, such an ad hominem attack. But if there ever was an alliance that was anti-Semitic, this is the alliance. As we saw in that March for Israel a while ago, where they featured hateful speakers, seriously hateful speakers. So in terms of...
I just want to add one thing, Marcy, is the anti-Palestinian hate that we're seeing, anti-Arab, Islamophobia. And not only do we see it in these horrific kind of violence against the young boy who was stabbed, against the three Palestinians who were attacked in Vermont, but also the advocates in Washington who are part of Muslim organizations. We saw it just today when we were at the embassy of Israel, where there was a protest organized by American Muslims for Palestine. And the Israelis had big trucks. How many trucks, Anne?
At least three of them.
At least three big trucks that have those billboards on the side. And they had pictures of people who were captured by Hamas. And it says, American Muslims for Palestine, AMP, loves Hamas. And it was really a direct attack on this group that has been organizing a lot of very good protests around Washington, D.C. and all over the country, equating their love for their own people in Palestine with being supporters of terrorism. So we feel a real obligation to be out there to support whatever they are doing.
I agree. It's so important right now to express solidarity, to show up for our Palestinian brothers and sisters. That doesn't mean we don't mourn the loss of life, the kidnappings of Israelis. But there's no comparison when you look at what's going on in Gaza right now. We are witnessing in real time genocide. And I've often wondered, you know, where were those Germans during the Holocaust, the Nazi Holocaust, the concentration camps? What did they do? Why did so many remain silent? And yet you look around and you can hear the silence, right?
So right. I would just... Yeah, as you implied, we all want the hostages to come home. And we saw a number of them coming home during these days when the bombing was stopped. But now that the bombing started again, there's not going to be a release of hostages. So it doesn't even make sense from that side of wanting to see the hostages released.
Correct. And I want to talk about the supplemental in a minute. But first, Anne, I want to ask you about the State Department, because you worked for the State Department. How many years?
16 years in the State Department.
Okay, so you're our resident expert on the State Department. So I read, I think it was in The Intercept, that there's so much dissension within the State Department over the Secretary of State Blinken's support, aiding and abetting Israeli genocide, that the State Department had to set up a separate communication, a portal for dissidents to talk about their frustrations. I guess this was a way of hopefully preventing them from resigning and making a public display of their dissatisfaction and outrage. What's your take on what's happening in the State Department right now?
Well, it's very heartening. It's very good to hear of this dissension that so many people are challenging the Biden administration and Blinken, the right-hand person of Joe Biden, in their love for every criminal act that the state of Israel is doing. So there are people behind the scenes that are standing up to it. Josh Paul is the only one that we know of that's resigned at this point over it. But to know that there are a lot of people that behind the scenes are saying this is wrong. And as Medea mentioned earlier, in USAID, which is an agency of the State Department, over 1,000 people have signed a letter on that. We know in the White House that there's disagreement, dissent there about it. So that gives you heart that within the Washington bureaucracy, people are not going along with what the Biden administration wants. And while they haven't succeeded in truly changing the policy the way we want it, you can see you can hear the change in language that the Biden administration has been forced to use. It hasn't stopped the bombing, but it is at least, words that we can try to hold them to, although that's not saving lives right at the moment.
That's true. It's not saving lives. So we just have to keep on demanding a ceasefire, a lifting of the siege of Gaza. There's no military solution. We know that. There has to be a political solution. Personally, I am for one vote, one person, one vote in all of historic Palestine. That would be a democracy. Okay, let's take a look at the supplemental appropriation that Biden wants. It's $105 billion package that he's asking for. $61.4 billion for Ukraine, $14.3 billion for Israel, $7.4 billion for Taiwan and the Indo-Pacific, $13.6 billion for the border, and $9 billion for humanitarian aid for Palestine, Israel, and Ukraine. Now, this is presenting quite a challenge to those in Congress, not because they're not supportive of the military-industrial complex, because they have their own issues. So maybe we can break it down a little, and you can tell us what's going on with this supplemental.
Well, first, there's the House side, in which Republicans were forced, because of Republicans who don't want aid to Ukraine, to separate the money out and just vote on the money for Israel, which they did, and it passed overwhelmingly. But but no Democrats voted for it, because the $14.6 billion was offset by cutting the Internal Revenue Service by that same amount. And Democrats did not want to do that. So that bill is totally unacceptable in the Senate, where the Democrats control the Senate. And Chuck Schumer said it's a non-starter. They want to bundle this all together so that you would have the money for Ukraine, which the Biden administration really wants, and most of the Democrats and Republicans want that as well. The money for Israel, which will pass very easily, unfortunately, because both the Democrats and Republicans majority want it. And then there is the bitter pill that the Democrats don't want, which is all this money to militarize the border even further. And then there is the Indo-Pacific money, which it seems like there's not a lot of contention about that, although there should be. Mm-hmm. And then this little bit of humanitarian aid, which is supposed to sweeten the pot for those Democrats who care about whether people have some food to eat. So it's a big mishmash. It's a big mess. And from our point of view as Code Pink, we don't want to see that money, that bill passed at all. And we don't want the more progressive Democrats or the more liberal Democrats to vote for it, because they'll say, oh, well, we want the humanitarian aid for Gaza. We say we'd rather have nothing for Gaza and not have $14 billion more money for Israel.
Exactly. You're talking about a pittance for Gaza. I'm just...
Let me just mention a pittance. I mean, what the U.S. gives is a pittance. And right now, the people of Gaza are staying alive, not by U.S. donations and U.S. government, USAID stuff. I don't think any USAID trucks have ever gotten into Gaza. These are all international trucks from various organizations, but not USAID.
That's right. In fact, on the second half of Code Pink Radio, we will be interviewing the executive director in D.C. of UNRWA, the UN agency that services those in Gaza, the Palestinians. And he will tell us that the donations they are getting are from individuals in the United States. All right. Thank you so much. Medea Benjamin, co-founder of Code Pink. Anne Wright, former State Department official who resigned to protest the U.S. invasion of Iraq. Stay strong, ladies, sisters. We're with you.
Thanks, Marcy.
Thank you.
Palestine! فلسطيني فلسطيني أنا اللي اسمي يكفيني
أنا الصامت على أرضي ورافع على السما جبيني
فلسطيني فلسطيني
فلسطيني فلسطيني أنا اللي اسمي يكفيني أنا الصامت على أرضي ورافع
شراييني فلسطين ولهون وبس عموتي هالوطن ينمس أنا روحي في دال القدس لبي لو تناديني
فلسطيني فلسطيني أنا اللي اسمي يكفيني
أنا الصامد على أرضي ورافع على السما جبيني
فلسطيني فلسطيني
Welcome back to Code Pink Radio. I'm Marcy Winograd, and that was Mohammed Asaf, a Palestinian singer and star of Arab Idol. Our next guest is William Deere, who serves as director of the Washington, D.C. Office of the United Nations Relief and Works Agency for Palestine Refugees, UNRWA. In his position, Bill is part of the UNRWA team securing funding for the agency on Capitol Hill.
Frankly, nowhere in Gaza is safe. These folks were asked to relocate from the north to the south. And, you know, we've already lost over 110 employees ourselves to this situation. And, you know, it with more than half of them having perished in the southern half of Gaza, the part that was supposed to be the safe part. If it's okay with you, let me take a step back just tell listeners a little bit about the organization, because not everybody appreciates the importance, you know, what is UNRWA and why is it so important to the humanitarian response in Gaza? And the answer is this. UNRWA was formed in 1949 to provide humanitarian and human development services to Palestine refugees. It is not a permanent agency, believe it or not, even though we've been around since 1949. We have to have our mandate. Our boss is the United Nations General Assembly, and that mandate has to be renewed every 3 years, which occurred this time last year. The UNRWA has five operating fields, which are Jordan, Syria, Lebanon, the West Bank, including East Jerusalem, and our largest field, which is Gaza. Now, what makes UNRWA so unusual in the UN family is that we are what we call a direct service provider. So in other words, our organization doesn't write a check to someone to perform a humanitarian or human development service. We do it ourselves. That means that we run a school system. We run a primary healthcare network. We run a very elaborate social services network. So how does that translate to Gaza, our largest field? We have 300,000 girls and boys in grades in UNRWA schools, grades 1 to 9. We have 22 primary health centers scattered throughout Gaza. We have a social assistance network that provides food assistance to 1.2 million of Gaza's 2.2 million citizens. Now, when you combine that with the 300,000 folks that pre-October 7 were supported with food assistance from the World Food Program, what that means is 3 out of 4 Gazans, even before October 7th, were receiving over half their calorific need through international direct food assistance. Now, another part of this that folks, when we say direct food assistance, we mean it. In other words, UNRWA pre-October 7 was responsible for the importation of 60% of the food commodities that came into Gaza every month. And these were distributed in food packages on a quarterly basis. And it's things like rice, beans, flour, lentils, sunflower oil. The bigger the family, the more you get. And that required, believe it or not, very close cooperation with the Israeli security forces. You don't move that much food into the Gaza Strip every month without having a well-established set of procedures with the Israeli security forces. So it's that network, our network of schools, our network of warehouses, our fleet of trucks, our knowledge of how to move supplies around Gaza is exactly why we are the linchpin of the ongoing humanitarian response. We are sheltering 1.1 million displaced civilians at 156 of our locations. That includes some locations in the north. And it's hard to get, because of the security situation, a feel for how many folks are still up north. We were able during the humanitarian pause to get supplies up to some of our facilities in the north for the first time since, goodness me, October 12th, maybe. And I would say there are at a minimum 125,000 people still sheltering at UNRWA facilities in the north, although the number is probably higher.
Bill, I think you have this incredible task. So tell us about those.
There's a second war being fought out there. It is a war in cyberspace, on social media, by detractor organizations that want to undermine the UN's credibility writ large, but UNRWA specifically. And by doing that, they somehow, by doing that, perhaps they hope that donor states like the United States will cease their support for the agency, which would, of course, have a catastrophic effect on the humanitarian relief operation. Let me just give you an example from this very week of the sort of things that go on behind the scenes, but are playing out in the halls of Congress. A report came out on Tuesday that the German government, one of our major contributors, had stopped funding UNRWA. And here's the problem with it. It just wasn't true. Not only wasn't it true, it was so outrageous that the German Ministry of Foreign Affairs said, no, that's not true. In fact, UNRWA is an important humanitarian partner. One of the leading detractor points of contention is the outrageous idea that UNRWA schools teach incitement and anti-Semitism. I mean, it's just outrageous. And in fact, the agency spends a great deal of time and money making sure we do the exact opposite, believe it or not. But it's the Middle East, Marcy. Let's be honest. Everything's complicated. So in all refugee education modes, the UN always uses the textbook of the host country. And that's for two reasons. First of all, it's the host country. But second, it's also because we only teach through grade 9. The kids have to take entrance exams and they have to be integrated into the upper levels of the host country education system. But we're also the UN. So what that means is, Marcy, we literally review all 13,000 pages of Palestinian Authority textbooks. Every time a new textbook is released, we do what's called the rapid review process. And we review it against UN values and UNESCO education standards. And the truth is, about 3% of the pages have content on them that is outside of UN values. Most of them dealing with the occupation. Things that, like, for example, maps without Israel. Of course, we have maps in our classrooms. They're UN maps, and of course, Israel is on them. So, it's a completely Washington issue in one sense that, in a piece of legislation that was recently passed in the House, it cites UNRWA as an authority on content in Palestinian textbooks. But when you go to the floor of the House, they will then say UNRWA teaches incitement and anti-Semitism. I mean, you know, it does make your head spin a little bit. It's as if what they're suggesting is that, having studied the textbooks and identified the content, we don't do anything about it. Of course we do. We have what's called a critical thinking approach, which is, and it's a, you provide the teachers a critical thinking guide. And the responses to these 3% of material vary. Sometimes it's literally turn the page, keep moving. Other times you enter into a critical thinking discussion with the students. And you ask, and what you're doing is you're exposing them to the wider world. You're exposing them to other points of view. And, you know, what's interesting is I am a former Hill staffer. And like a lot of former Hill staffers, you want to see results from foreign aid. You want to see demonstrable, quantifiable results. You know, the funny part of it is, and one of the reasons I took the job was UNRWA actually gets quantifiable results. Our kids are grade ahead, a year ahead of their counterparts in host countries. And we not only achieve that result, we actually achieve it on a per student cost unit level lower than the host country. A study of Palestinian Authority textbooks by the Eckerd Institute. It was a study commissioned by the European Union, because this isn't just an issue unique to the United States. Also asked you to like, hey, let's get a grip. Their textbooks is how much socialization comes from the textbook versus walking to school every day in a camp. And I've walked the streets of some of those refugee camps with, you know, bullet holes in the walls and tear gas canisters lying in the street. I mean, there's a lot of other socialization going on here besides the material and the curriculum.
Thank you. Now let's revisit this challenge on Capitol Hill. And perhaps you can give us an overview of the funding for UNRWA, the United Nations
Sure.
Relief Agency for Palestinian Refugees. You know, how much are you dependent on funding from the United States? And with Republicans controlling the House, how much of an obstacle is this?
Well, let's begin at the beginning. First, all UNRWA contributions, all UNRWA funding is voluntary contributions by donor states. In other words, the U.S. pays the United Nations every year dues based on a formula. And every few years, you know, they negotiate that formula. UNRWA is an agency of the United Nations, but its funding is voluntary, which means that any nation writes a check over and above their regular dues to the United Nations in order to fund the agency. And of course, at the moment, the United States is the largest contributor. Behind it is Germany, the European Union, a number of other European countries. So in during the Trump administration, the Trump administration ended the, at that point, 70-year relationship between the U.S. and UNRWA. In fact, the U.S. was one of the founders of UNRWA, leading the cause for its creation at the General Assembly. The relationship between the U.S. and UNRWA was reestablished in the current administration. We received $337 million in 2021. We received $344 million from the U.S. last year. And as you can imagine, those numbers are a little higher right now. Last I looked, it was about $425 million so far this year, all in. And it's important. I mean, it's so remember, I think I mentioned earlier that we have 33,000 staff, most of them, with the exception of a couple hundred folks like me, they're all Palestine refugees. They're the teachers, they're the nurses, they're the doctors, they're the folks running the food distribution network.
Okay, so when the Democrats controlled the House, Barbara Lee from California, she was the chair of the Operations Committee in the House.
Correct.
She's no longer chair because the Republicans control the House, the Senate, and the Senate. The Democrats control the Senate by a slim majority, very slim. So is your funding in jeopardy or not from the United States?
I would say that we do not take it for granted. There was a floor vote in, I believe, when did my hair start turning white? Goodness me, September maybe? We survived a vote to prohibit funding the UNRWA by 6 votes in the House. So it was by not a slam dunk by any means. So we're always mindful. And just to understand, for folks to understand some things, because it gets to the battles that we fight here. Before UNRWA is given a single, penny by the United States government, the State Department has to report to Congress on 7 aspects of our operation. So it is, as someone said the other day at the State Department, one of the most oversighted accounts in the United States government.
Thank you for clarifying that. Bill, let's talk about what's happening in Gaza right now as Israel has resumed its bombardment. You mentioned that one of UNRWA's main missions is to provide education for refugees, including refugees in Gaza. So these children, the youth who are in the camps now or the centers, are they, with all of this mayhem and bombardment that encompasses this narrow strip, are you delivering any education, any schooling? Is that even possible?
It's not possible right now. It's what we are delivering for the kids right now is psychosocial support. And in the 5 years I've been with the agency, frankly, we've seen a growing need for that psychosocial support. These are young folks who have never grown up not knowing conflict in some way or another, living through airstrikes, the 2014 war. First of all, recall most of our facilities are now being used as our school facilities are now shelters, where we're it's very important. Obviously, education is important, but I got to be honest with you, Marcy. Right now, we're hard pressed to make sure that there is enough food, water, and medicine getting to these schools where families are sheltering, and let alone the idea that we'll be able to restart education anytime soon. And it's going to be, because we don't know how this is going to end, no one can tell you how this is going to end. We have a number of facilities that we had to evacuate, that we have reports that both side combatants have used our facilities as firing positions. There has not been a great deal of respect for the blue flag right now, sadly. And so we're not sure what we're going to find. It's when we're able to go back to these places, let alone if you look at the level of destruction in northern Gaza, folks, you have to ask yourself, well, how many folks will be able to return and what will they be able to return to? So we don't have a lot of illusions that our schools are going to be able to be refurbished and put back into shape anytime soon.
Well, thank you so much, Bill Deere, Executive Director of the Washington, D.C. Office of the United Nations Relief and Works Agency for Palestine Refugees, UNRWA, for all that you do and for all that UNRWA is doing to address the needs of those in Gaza. William Deere, Executive Director of UNRWA, the UN agency serving Palestinian refugees. Before that, we spoke with Medea Benjamin and Anne Wright, organizers with Code Pink. I'm Marcy Winograd for Code Pink Radio. Thank you for joining us. Ceasefire.
Bush and Bin Laden, you think they're foes? They're in business together. Daddy Bush knows the Carlyle Group since years before been raking in billions and itching for more.
It's blood for oil. We know there's a link.
They say Code War.
They call pink.
It's blood for oil.